going to be embarrassed.
I'm going to read. There's a the images that come up here are like a parallel universe, and occasionally the planets coincide with the text. So there's two readings, if you like. thank you very much for coming. I will try this evening to explain why I believe we're on the cusp of a new paradigm, a seriously important new movement in urbanity and architecture, derived from a synthesis of science and ethics and the creative desire of man to express himself unselfishly. This opposes superficial and selfish architecture that gratifies itself on hyperbole, the first, the biggest, the latest, most innovative, which more often than not represent media and consumer-induced self-engrandissements, and recent architectural isms derived from some narrow perspective of recent mathematics or from much-promoted literary theories such as structuralism, post-structuralism, and deconstructivism. I'm not discussing these, for I sense that they are fugitive phenomena. Intelligent, social, and selfless architectural expression, capable of the most marvelous and spiritually uplifting structures, has to confront turn-of-the-century stunt-making architectural gymnastics. This is a genuine challenge in the face of an insatiable appetite for the new, the different, and the unique image that drives the notion of progress in the present economy and society of the so-called developed world. I will address five questions. One, how does our intellectual heritage shape our actions? Two, what are we thinking about today? Three, how are we behaving as designers? Four, how do we value and measure beauty today? And five, how should we design today? Innovate or die? And then there'll be a short conclusion, if you're still here. So the first question, in theory this is, how does our intellectual heritage shape our actions? I want to step back 2,500 years in order to hint at the origins of our present discomfort of having to live with apparent contradictions, and in particular how that remaining part of Homo sapiens sapiens has to face up to and find ways of taming a rampant Homo faber and Homo consumeris. The Greeks sought to reconcile the ideas of perpetual change and eternal becoming, put forward by Heraclitus, with those of the unchangeable being, put forward by Parmenides. The outcomes were to have a profound impact upon the development of our Western society. The paradox was resolved when the Greeks thought of the atom as the inert, fundamental, unchangeable being, yet which, moved by undefined forces, spirits, could combine with other atoms to generate change. Nevertheless, the wholeness of life had been split between spirit and matter, between body and soul, and investigations of the human soul and ethics, rather than materials, dominated Western thinkers and society until the Renaissance, when there was a renewed interest in matter and the natural world. Descartes focused this division in the Renaissance, giving a subtle new dimension to it, the idea of mind and matter. He separated man from nature, the subject from the object. Rather than finding ourselves at one with nature, Descartes indicated a path separating us further from nature towards a world where man thought himself more important than nature, and which has framed man's actions in exploiting its riches for his own benefit. The split of the whole was reflected centuries later by those at the Bauhaus into beauty and reason, art and technology, freedom and necessity. Meanwhile, in other regions of the world, there was no such apparent split. Ways of living, beliefs, not religions, such as Buddhism and Taoism, in the East bear witness to this, and describe, much as Heraclitus did, the cyclical nature of change. Our Western ways during the last few hundred years have impacted upon the traditions of other cultures and upon the nature of the planet we share. At the risk of oversimplification, the history of geographic expansionism seems to have a predictable sequence. First come spies, historically they were the priests, followed by soldiers to take the territory, which then allows merchants to exploit, and finally artists arrive, if at all, to question or comfort. Outer space seems to be following the same trajectory. Urbanism and architecture are not isolated from this cycle. And in this cycle lies the idea of progress. At a metaphysical level, one could look at progress from the Greeks' notion of being through to Descartes' rationality, and also at the notion of art's progress from the artwork as an integral aspect of religious and secular power to its current notion of art producing independent aesthetic objects. Civilization, according to the late American social anthropologist Stanley Diamond, said, may be regarded as a system in internal disequilibrium. Technology or ideology or social organization are always out of joint with each other. And that's what propels the system along a given track. Our sense of movement, of incompleteness, contributes to the idea of progress. To put it another way, when we're able to appreciate the way the world is really working, it's never quite the way we would like it to be working. And this is why designing a better future is so challenging. I hope it's clear that the paradigm I'm referring to is far more than some architectural style. Also, I hope to show that it has to become more than the conventional notion of sustainable architecture or development. It has to recognize a world that has already urbanized and is globalizing with little evident shared humanity. For those of us living in economically powerful post-industrial societies, it is about a fundamental change in the way we think, behave towards each other, design and make things. Question two, what are we thinking about today? Recalling Descartes, I think, therefore I am or I exist. Homo faber, I think, therefore I make. Homo consumeris, I buy, therefore I am. Homo sapiens sapiens, I exist, therefore I care. Our individual and collective thinking is sandwiched between a moral environment full of bureaucratic rules and regulations telling us how to behave and to design, and a moral vacuum where international agencies acting on behalf of our conscience cost us the occasional coin dropped into an Amnesty or Greenpeace collection box or envelope. Then we proceed to consume their moral actions through the reports in the media, in much the same way that we consume the products of our technology. We are, ironically, becoming less responsible for our lives, not more so. In the West, we have become the product of our own economic thinking, to the point where financial reward can be obtained from being irresponsible, from not caring for others or our environment. The decline in the only lifelong relationship we have, the family, is parallel in the rise of an increasingly contractual and litigious social world. The quality of life is strained, and most people cannot choose or control it. This leads to a sense of alienation, of loneliness. Not in the sense of not having people around, for our urbanization contradicts this, but in the sense of seeing ourselves as more than vessels of blood held together by bones and skin. Vessels containing a spirit of life that may suggest to us an idea of the point of life, a point or moment when life gives us a sense of its richness, of meaning or value. Surviving what life's chance puts in front of us is the reality for most people, and finding time to make sense of its complexities is compounded in a process of urbanization whose in-migration destabilizes both city and countryside. Martin Jacques wrote recently of the family in The Guardian as the central site of intimacy, as expressed between family members. He said, intimacy is a function of time and permanence and rests on mutuality and unconditionality and is rooted in trust. As such, it is the antithesis of the values engendered by the market. Intimacy belongs in the realm of the spirit, as does love, not of the body or matter. And it is becoming more elusive. Let's not delude ourselves. We live in an age of quantity, not quality, of individualism, not community, and it is so evident all around us. We live to produce, consume, and to waste. Life without meaning becomes shopping for the sake of it. The shift from settled to dynamic communities, where the void of community life is filled with the artifice of the media, is slowly reducing our sensitivities towards each other. It only takes one generation to really care, and we have a real chance for positive change. Similarly, it takes only one alienated generation, satiated on technological media game playing and voyeuristic gratification, growing up with a decreasing experience of stable human relationships, within which a sense of security, love, care, and sharing are nurtured, for our hopes to see a better world all but vanish. Most of my generation has lived as if there was no tomorrow, but there are also many who have sensed its loss of soul, questioned the meaning of progress, and have wanted to do something about the loss of values. Our mental structures were honed over millions of years of living in small tribal groups, and we bring the same structures to bear on an existence that has changed materially, however we measure it, by several orders of magnitude. The rate of technological progress towards the illusory mastery of nature bears no relation to the rate at which human social evolution can keep pace with the consequences. Our Western capitalist culture continues to deny the natural environment by exploiting it. The rape of nature's resources to make money in order that we can measure growth through GDP is still totally embedded in our society's idea of civilization. Our culture is dominated by economics and by economists who remain insufficiently engaged with creating methodologies that embrace the needs of the wider natural environment and of the poor. Economic growth has been dependent on the political and industrial exploitation of scientific investigation and upon exploiting individuals within society. The individual economic effort is now so divorced from life that it is not surprising that so many people long for recognition within a group outside of the workplace. Nearly 40 years ago, Robert Kennedy wrote a text entitled The American Environment. Can't do his accent. And let us be clear at the outset that we will find neither national purpose nor personal satisfaction in a mere continuation of technological progress, in an endless amassing of worldly goods. We cannot measure national spirit by the Dow Jones average or national achievement by the gross national product. For the gross national product includes our pollution and advertising for cigarettes, and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and jails for people who break them, the destruction of redwoods and the death of Lake Erie. It grows with the production of napalm and missiles and nuclear warheads, and it even includes research on the improved dissemination of bubonic plague. It swells with the equipment for the police to put down riots in our cities, and though it is not diminished by the damage these riots do, still it goes up as slums are rebuilt on their ashes. It includes Whitman's rifle and Speck's knife, and the broadcasting of television programs which glorify violence to sell goods to our children. Our culture is driven by competition, not altruism, which in turn produces an aggressive, rough, tough and fast world in which matter matters, and fewer seem to benefit. Many designers have become preoccupied with the amount, nature, and ultimate life of this matter, and how it affects our environment. We seldom achieve progress in a universally agreed sense. The term is too loaded politically, since many of our notions of progress are achieved at the expense of the quality of life of others elsewhere in the world. Progress is fundamentally a journey of the individual, and all will measure it differently. Progress is inconsistent with a defined end. It is therefore difficult to find a consensual definition in a global society. More fundamentally, since the notion of progress exists in our definitions as a way of measuring where we are in some abstract continuum, it becomes a direction marker, a signpost indicating distance, or a speedometer, by which to navigate and predict our estimated time of arrival at different stages of our lives. The problem is to know when we have arrived. At this point, we have eliminated the sense of differential by which we can judge our position or direction. It's a bit like having a compass to find the North Pole. When you get there, you lose all sense of direction. So the end goal of progress is constantly to be redefined. And this process is part of a critical review of our advances since we last defined the goal. The idea of progress is also bound up with the polarization between optimist and pessimist. Those who can embrace the future and deal with uncertainty, as opposed to those whose insecurity drives them to cling to what they think they know. Often we have the impression of 20th century attitudes to progress and the future as being characterized by optimism and above all certainty. Architectural modernism grew out of this and was underpinned by a desire to share the fruits of progress through new housing, educational and welfare facilities with as many people as possible. This was the last real architectural movement that was founded on an idea more fundamental than finding a new superficial or spatial aesthetic. Modernism's basis was essentially humanist, where technology would serve society. However, its aesthetic has proved too hard and too cold for society to readily accept. And only recently there has been a sustained and significant reference to doubt about the essential goodness of the direction in which the developed world was progressing. The new paradigm is predicated on the notion of sharing, not the fruits of a limitless fossil fuel economy, but on the understanding that we share this planet with each other and with all life, and that every one of our actions affects our environment. So how are we behaving as designers? Third question. This image is from Canary Wharf in the docks. The duck died 3 weeks later, but they put a new one back. Sustainable, like the word environment, is so general a term that it can be interpreted and appropriated by all types of government, companies, institutions, and agencies, rendering it almost meaningless. And architects are often principal actors in presenting environmentally coded images of sustainable architecture, such appearances, of course, being a useful cachet to help secure a commission or a planning permission. I think that most designers believe they are essentially doing good. Nowadays, when I attempt to solve a problem or derive a design solution, I try to expand our analysis to include a more complex global vision of interdependence. But in simple terms, most of us believe that a sustainable approach is one which gets more value out of less material, pollutes less, wastes less, and recycles more, and, quote, does not reduce the next generation's choices. This, I suspect, is not yet mature. but in the absence of a more profound approach, we struggle along. The more recent origin of this approach was the oil crisis of the mid-1970s, and a gradual realization that fossil fuels might just run out one day. The discovery of the hole in the ozone layer 20 years ago made the industrialized nations wake up a little bit more. We've been reminded regularly of this precarious state through the Kyoto Protocol. And of course, everybody will be aware of last week's announcement by the International Climate Change Task Force. And they informed us that there's a limit to the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. We know that this will directly affect livelihoods, economies, and political decision-making. The cap-and-trade carbon market is one reactive mechanism. The impact of legislation and technological change on energy consumption still remains very, very weak. The ways in which we use or waste energy seem part of a world power game. Europe, along with the USA, which currently emits some 25% of the CO2 into the atmosphere, continues to exert a disproportionate influence in the exploitation of the Earth's resources. And energy is one of the most dramatic instances of this. The ethos of the so-called right of the individual to enjoy freedom, of private transport, the products of energy-intensive industry, and an inefficient but comfortable home and work environment is demanding a very high price. I think that we will have a much cleaner energy society, electrical energy society, one day. But to get there solely with safe renewable sources will be very, very, very difficult. And some societies will almost certainly have to revisit the nuclear source on the way, as Finland decided to do last October. Our need for and dependency upon fossil fuels, particularly oil, makes us insecure. So if we can use less of it and find renewable alternatives, then we can feel more secure, because we will be more independent. If this independence is one basis for the promotion of alternative energy, then one must hope that this renewed confidence, when it comes, will not seek more expansionism, but altruism. At the moment, the contradictions between helping to create a more intelligent world in which moral and social justice rather than economic justice prevails, and producing architecture within the current economic model are inescapable. And in a way, this conundrum is the one that's concerned me since I began my own practice in 1976. One can try as an architect to make the built environment more visually and spatially attractive. One can express a need to deprocess and decontaminate the manufacture, distribution, and consumption of building materials and energy in the interest of conserving natural resources and reducing toxin emissions. I even found a visual statement, a sort of metaphorical intelligence, through this way of thinking and designing. However, this cannot hide the underlying local and global social trends that more and more people are feeling disenfranchised. There is no doubt that as the world feels smaller, there is not only a mutual assimilation of cultural activity, banal as much of it appears to be, but also a subversion of differences through the products we design, whether they be international architectures that have no contextual or aesthetic frontiers, mobile visiphones, cars, DVD players, or clothing. One might even suggest that there has been a blurring of East and Western aesthetics. The unforgettable title of Ian McCarg's book, Design with Nature, published in 1969, represents in many ways my approach to design. This has perhaps more in common with the traditional aesthetics of the East, where I spent some time in the early 1970s. And this aesthetic does not seek to impose form upon the landscape, but to allow it to emerge from it, not to control it, but to be part of it, and not to assert one's own identity, but to be absorbed by the environment. Western capitalism is part of the Far East economic culture, and has now entered China's commercial communist culture. For these people's cultures, the invasive power of recent Western economic thinking has also had a destabilizing effect on their design culture. In architecture, the spread of modernism, brutalism, and high-tech aesthetics reflected the globalization of architectural style that occurred during the 20th century. Cultural differences are becoming invisible to the eye, but perhaps not in the mind. It is here that the soul or spirit of place and object resides. And another one. Thank you. Forward. You've got a very sensitive little mouse here. Thank you. With this globalization, which we find at its most banal in fast food, fast movies, and fast games, is there about to be a backlash from designers? Can we see the signs that suggest a new tendency, less towards even greater banality, more towards a creative syntrophy from cultural differences that will produce new aesthetic diversity that expresses a revitalized sense of being and meaning? Can designers help to rethink design to respond to this challenge? Or is our work, like that of product designers, in the end simply to be consumed because our designs are more attractive to the client, who is, after all, the first consumer of our architecture? The tragedy is that design in our present society remains judged both in terms of quality and quantity by the question, does it attract the consumer? We designers may think that we have more noble standards of providing functional artifacts that are environmentally and culturally sensitive. But are we deluding ourselves? Do we actually need most of the things we design? Do they simply serve to perpetuate the status quo? Humanity and intelligence have as much to do with the process of decision-making and progress as the tangible artifacts that result from our application of science, technology, and economics to matter. So the need for evident intelligence and humanity in what we are doing is indisputable, and I think it's a beautiful idea. As my work shows, I'm not suggesting any sentimentality of attachment to the past that nearly always encourages a misplaced desire to visually imitate it. That motive is usually delusional and symptomatic of a loss of faith in the present and a fear of the future. This notion is very different from a concern about the decay of society and the loss of humanitarian values. All too often, we see escapist reproductions of an ersatz glamorized version of a past that only exists in storybooks and the imagination. A happy, sanitized rural or village idyll, devoid of all reality, hardship, poverty, exploitation, illness, and early death. It is as if grasping the image will bring us closer to an imagined set of spiritual values. My conceptual thinking has always sought wholeness through the integration and synthesis of art, science, technique, landscape, and economy in its broadest sense. I have searched for ways of designing architecture that is landscape and not simply an architecture that integrates landscape or is conceived as an object in landscape. The natural and man-made landscape is physical space. My architecture starts in the spaces I create in my mind. It is vital that I am able to explore these spatial landscapes of a project within my mind and then connect them to the physical landscapes. Since my first project in France in 1976 until now, I have made a commitment to the values of efficiency, economy, and aesthetics. Aesthetics is useless, unquantifiable work, but has as much, if not more, impact upon how we feel than the other two put together. The way I look at this is that in any project, efficiency and economy are rightly expected by most clients and represent those two most tangible aspects of time and money. While the latter involves the designer in investigation, research, and rejection of ideas of space, feeling, and appearance. These need and take time and do not appear to directly profit the client, or the architect for that matter. And often the client sees no real point in paying for them. However, designers must invest time in them. If these less tangible issues, for that is what they are until the work is realized, are driven by the moral dimension of aesthetics that embrace the idea that we design not just to satisfy the immediate needs of our client, but for future generations, then the aesthetic issues become far more significant. The result of giving value to the moral aesthetic as well as the appearance of the work is that it will indicate how responsibly we have acted with regard to future generations. It is a key part of the Homo faber, or Homo sapiens inheritance, that we will pass on. So the fourth question, how do we value or measure beauty today? To be able to read our reality requires a reference, our dreams. And some of our dreams question reality's reality. Anyone who has spent time watching clouds, waves crashing upon a beach, or a sunset knows that their view of these realities are processed through the mind. And consequently, the mind's filters of education and culture ensure that each person will see them differently. Yet they represent the non-linear world that nature presents to us. And I am convinced that beauty is in large measure non-linear. I believe it is also related to the idea of liberty and the absence of boundaries and even time. One problem with creating architectural beauty is finding ways to express, or rather allow the play of nature's non-linearity. We often see literal architectural design proposals, surface, elemental, and spatial representations of certain states and interpretations of non-linearity. One can think of, obviously, fractal architecture. They are easily read as images, to be consumed rather than profound investigations into capturing some elusive and wonderful phenomena that surrounds us. To capture or express the beauty of non-linearity surely demands that architecture and architectural space itself is dynamic. It is possible to freeze, but it will essentially lose its fluidity. The flame is non-linear. Copper is linear. Both can reveal the energy of sunset. The flame has it, the copper reflects it. The reflective quality of materials has always appealed to me. I see reflections of the clouds moving, the sun setting, and the raindrop falling, and interfering with these reflections as a genuine source of beauty of the non-linear. There is delight in the contribution from the surface that reveals transformational qualities, sensitivity to light and shadow, to burning sun or pouring rain, to change, albeit slowly, not to stay the same forever. When a log burns, there is the beauty of the flame that never stops changing, and behind the flame, the log that is slowly transforming into ash. The water that forms a wave, breaks, foams, and reforms as a retreating surface, always comes back, in part, as a new wave. These events are magical. The time frame of architecture is perhaps longer, but one needs to feel that, like the stone the priests touch each time they pass, it is changing in response to its environment. And like the stone, it will inevitably disappear under the pressure of the forces of its environment. This is to imagine architecture that can endure, but also decay beautifully. It has been argued that classical beauty demands aesthetic purity. This was Mr. Baumgarten in the 1700s, to whom the term aesthetics is attributed. Classical in the sense that nothing can be added or removed without destroying it. That is, there's a unified totality, a world in itself. Can architecture ever achieve this level of beauty if self-sufficiency is critical to our perception of such beauty? If aesthetic purity is essential to beauty, then architecture with its functional raison d'être and contextual location can never achieve aesthetic virginity. Architecture, when seen through classical aesthetics, has an eternal dilemma. If autonomy or self-sufficiency is a critical ingredient of art, and this criterion is applied to a definition of architectural beauty, then the aesthetic object, that is, architecture, or the building, would have to stand alone without context. For me, this criterion has to be questioned. And I think there are three possibilities. One, architecture always responds to its context. And if this principle is accepted, then we have to define architectural beauty differently from classical definitions of art. Two, the aesthetic architectural object denies its context totally while attempting to remain within classical definitions of art. If this is pursued, then it would follow that its functionality, its raison d'etre, is also irrelevant, for this forms part of its context. And the third one, the architectural object denies both context and function, and is no longer an architecture as we have understood it. This would suggest that such an architectural work is itself, exists only for itself, and creates its own world. It makes the architectural object an art object, not architecture. I believe that architecture has to redefine its own aesthetic language of architectural beauty. Most of our investigations of beauty in architecture, as against beauty in art, have revolved around the wholeness, the harmony of the work, and the role that decoration and ornament have had in achieving or destroying architectural beauty. This wholeness has been revealed in history through different styles. They were essentially communicating the spirit of their age. The style of an age matures when there appears to be a shared ideology between the artist and society, a sort of collective visual hymn. In classical terms, some notions of style, such as Rococo and more recently postmodern, went awry because they were add-ons to the underlying form. They were not integrated or part of the whole. I would suggest that ornament is the last, but not necessarily the least important part of the whole in a classical aesthetic. Ornament, in classical times, presented the communal ethos. Ornament cannot exist on its own, whereas decoration can. Decoration is a transferable product of manipulating and applying patterns upon surfaces. These products depended upon the patterns intuited from nature and mimetic reflections that were available to different societies at different times. Decoration is an aesthetic addition. Modernism's dream has been accompanied by its own recognition that it has failed to deliver the integrated whole from its exploitation of technology for humanity. Despite its roots in socialism, and seeing that agenda supplanted by a rampant capitalism for the few, modernism has not matured as an architecture accepted by the masses, of which a fundamental aspect must be to provide or create social, human places of visual delight from the techno-potential available to building. It also seems to have failed because it has appeared too impersonal, and it is in the dwelling, rather than the workplace, the factory or the office, that the impersonal is most felt, and where modernism style, with no evident ornament, has been least accepted. Many books and propositions have been made on the subject of ornament and decoration, and the RA Forum of Artists and Architects debated this subject a couple of years ago, following a proposal by Tom Phillips, RA, to differentiate between decoration and ornamentation. In response, I put forward an alternative perspective based on the idea of pattern. Patterns belong to life. One could say that patterns are life. In my opinion, this is where the essential lies, in life itself and in discovering the patterns of and in life. This gives us a basis to our lives today. And in this basis is different, and this basis is different from the former times because we have had new patterns of nature revealed to us. When man arranges bones or stones, throws paint at a wall, crashes electrons in a particle accelerator, or writes an article, he is expressing life, not ornament. We make patterns from what surrounds us and what comes from our minds. We construct symmetrical and asymmetrical geometries, yet they still contain rhythm, proportion, and scale. Not long ago, we discovered the structure and pattern of snowflake crystals, and recently fractals. Yet we do not literally see fractals in nature. We now believe that they are there because we humans have generated them. The atom, Aldous Huxley said, is highly organized, whereas the stone is not. The atom is a pattern, but the stone, although it is made up of these patterns, is a mere confusion. It's only when life appears that you begin to get organization on a larger scale. I'm seeking new interrelationships through a holistic embrace of issues that will eventually become manifest through the design of our products. And these are informed by patterns we find in nature and human relationships at all scales. The intelligent use of these patterns will better reveal and inform these interrelationships. I think architecture doesn't really have a definitive notion of what constitutes beauty today. It's living with a flawed agenda. It is challenged by aesthetic architectures with little social or environmental ethos in the same way as much contemporary art. It is confronted by the power of image, a social phenomenon since the 60s. Susan Sontag very succinctly put it into perspective in her book Photography Unlimited. Reality has always been interpreted through the reports given by images, and philosophers since Plato have tried to loosen our dependence on images by evoking a standard of an image-free way of apprehending the real. To images, to strengthen. The credence that could no longer be given to realities understood in the form of images was now being given to realities understood to be images, illusions. David Hockney gave a wonderful talk last year on how optical instruments can be used to deceive and as photographic images can be manipulated to lie, arguing perhaps that painting is now a more truthful medium than either of the others. Reality is much tougher than the image which represents it. And the visual mediatization of architecture in all its forms leads inexorably to a valuation of architecture in terms of its new image, rather than any valued aesthetic or ethos. Consider our present society, where truth in design is considered, if at all, a secondary quality. We have become inured to the image that accompanies a consumer product, which is a representation systematically constructed as a separate entity to conform to the prefabricated desire of the consumer market. This representation takes on a primary role as a substitute for the profound meaning of the object itself. This distinction between image and meaning contributes to obscuring from our eyes the nature and importance of an object's indirect impact. For an object to have meaning, it must be perceived and experienced. Our reading of images is governed as much by our culture, the culture of communications, as by the media's aesthetic presentation of them. The screen world we all live in, with its distancing, is distancing us from the sensory world. Images have never before had such potential to contain so much information. But at the same time, they have never had such potential to contain disinformation. The line between fact and fiction is disappearing. We have to be able to distinguish between fact and fiction, and also between communication and discourse. clearly recognisable today that in order to bear the trials and tribulations of our split time existence, illusion through images has become a palliative, offering a zone of artificial comfort from reality, in much the same way that fashion does. I'm concerned about sustainability and overconsumption. Raising these concerns to aesthetic enjoyment is a vital aspect of design today. Why? If people can enjoy and read the meaning behind these designs, then perhaps there will be a general shift in attitude. Most commercial clients see projects in terms of economy and efficiency, with the aesthetics, the beauty bit, as an uneconomic add-on. The power of aesthetics is measured in the mind, not in the bank balance or electricity meter. The lack of it is like drip water torture. It numbs the mind. It is the lack of this aesthetic dimension which renders the cumulative effect of many parts of our built environment, from motorway barriers to retail industrial parks and hospitals, from advertising hoardings to ventilation grills, so demoralising. We talk of more and more city dwellers, of increasing the density of our cities as a sustainable model for the future. But what a terrible future for the next generations if the environment we create depresses us. The rapid post-war build of housing estates is a perfect illustration. As designers, we know that we have a moral obligation to far more people than our paymaster. However, the aesthetic dimension must include all our senses, and not just the classic five, but also temperature, pain, balance mechanisms, and internal sensors such as pressure. Consider the acoustic world we create. Designers can respond efficiently to current recommended or legal requirements about noise insulation and noise levels upon occupants within the buildings we design. But how often do we consider the first and second reflections of noise? For example, not considering how railway or other transport-generated sound affect nearby residents by primary and secondary reflection. Likewise, fire alarms and security announcements, the location of air handling plant, air exhausts and standby generators. Understanding and taking account of the indirect and hidden dimensions, as well as the obvious, will become an increasing responsibility of the designer as we densify, if we do, our cities. Yet it is these hidden dimensions, as well as those that we see, that determine the quality of life. If we do not get our cities right at the micro level, we could well end up with a cumulative effect upon our society, far worse than any environmental disaster caused by superbugs, toxins, or terrorists. In a world becoming more and more litigious, designers are being obliged to focus upon health and safety. How many of us regularly consider the impact of what we design upon the health of the mind? We know that we design the physical world around us, the machines and the built environment. This physicality enables us to live. But today, almost nothing is allowed to be designed by guesswork. Traditionally, we have to justify our design decisions to our clients through measurable things, economy and efficiency. I've talked of aesthetics in a broader sense, but how do we measure the effect of our designs upon the mind of the viewer or user? We don't really know. But old Vitruvius gave us the firmness, the buildability, commodity, the usefulness, and the delight, the aesthetic. We have learnt to measure buildability and usefulness, and designed to rules and predictable outcomes. Now we are trying to measure delight. We have begun to look at the effect of design upon our senses more seriously. The easiest to understand have been measured: vision, hearing, and temperature. We have not really considered smell, for example, to anywhere near the same degree. Consider the late-night washing machine and restaurant exhausts. It is not unreasonable to try and measure delight. Designers shouldn't fear that they will be governed by rules of delight. We simply need to understand better how our designs affect people's senses and their perceptions. Over the last 15 years, I've been exploring touch in design. It became central when we designed the Ecology Gallery at the Natural History Museum in 1989. It was reinforced when I was invited to give a paper on touch and architecture at Bonn's Kunsthalle in 1995. My talk there came between a cosmetic surgeon and the Australian artist Stellarc, who uses his body as his artistic palette and instrument. Recently, we realised a soft metal building. Nearly all metal buildings